This week on the Best of Flashpoints, we rebroadcast excerpts of our documentaries produced from occupied Palestine as Palestinians fight ethnic cleansing in East Jerusalem, regreen their land in the West Bank, and commemorate resistance inside the Green Line. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. In the occupied West Bank in Palestine, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This Earth Day in occupied Palestine, the last rain has finished its wet sweep over the ancient land as carpets of deep red hanun, or ranunculus flowers, burst into another sparkling spring. But even within the renewed grace of a turning season, Israel's 62-year-old colonial military occupation disfigures the scenery as Palestinians lose their land to Israeli settlement colonies in the West Bank, bury another family member in the wrecked open-air prison of Gaza, or wait for hours at Israeli checkpoints and years inside prisons. As always in this part of the world, exquisite beauty and bottomless despair interweave. Together they become a living, breathing microcosm of the human capacity for both unmitigated suffering and resourceful tenacity. The Wadi, desert valley near the Bustan Karaka farm in Beit Sahur was, hundreds of years ago, home to a thicket of oak and pistachio trees, one of innumerable and vast forests that stretch from modern-day Lebanon down to the Sinai. Today, the Wadi is a tumble of sparse, cream-colored hillsides that sprout a few sun-bleached bushes and some scraggly 200-year-old olive trees clinging tenuously to the sandy rocks. The physical violence of the many occupations and conquests of Palestine, together with over-farming, regional toxic pollution, and global climate change, is accelerating the desertification of this Wadi and many others like it. And, noticing the mandatory need for both sustainable environmental adaptation and collective resistance to the current Israeli stranglehold, Palestinians have begun to regreen the land, reclaiming the ancient ways of growing crops and going off the grid, using what we in the States would call doctrines of permaculture. Palestinians under military occupation here see it as a necessary means of empowerment and food security within an ever-changing and uncertain landscape. Palestinians in the area say they are excited about this regreening movement. Munther is a volunteer at the Bustan Karaka farm.
My name is Munther, and I love this place very much. It's a special place for me. Well, actually, because I live here, I am born here. Then all my memories, it's here. So I cannot never leave this place alone. So I come here. All the time I am here, so as I told you, I love this place very much, just like this.
It's so quiet. It's amazing. It kind of reminds me of what Palestine probably was like before the occupations of even the Ottomans. I mean, it's very, like, nothing's moving. It's all very still, and it smells great. How does it feel for you to walk around this kind of place, see things growing, and know that it's part of something bigger?
Yes. First, thank you. You said it's quiet. Yes, it's very, very, very quiet and make me relax. So I come here every Sunday to relax. And also, as you can see, the agriculture, everything it's grown. In the summer, you can see everything, it's green. It's amazing color for us, really.
How does this kind of farm and this kind of practices within this farm and this community, how does that help the Palestinian struggle?
Yes, it's help very much. The first thing that my grandfather had do it in this ground. So I am here to learn a new way to be a farmer, good farmer. So it's a beautiful thing that can help many Palestinians. So come here, just learn a new way to have a farm.
Yeah, so it's quite a short-lived small tree.
Thomas, a volunteer from the United Kingdom, plants new saplings in a terrace garden overlooking the valley.
Yeah, this is the tree nursery, really. Along here we've got some vegetable beds, things like ful, fakus, kusa, like sunflowers, about 30 different vegetable crops all grown together very intensively, like sown right next to each other, but at different times. So as one crop comes to fruition, you can take the fruits and or the leaves and then, whoops, and then leave the rest.
Describe kind of the tenets of permaculture and why it's important to bring permaculture practices here to Palestine.
Yeah. Well, permaculture's it's an old idea. It's coined a new term for. I mean, you could replace the term with common sense, in my opinion. It's about sustainable living, be that as part of an agricultural system or just, you know, domestically, even if you don't have access to any land. It's about using what you've got where you've got it, trying to get the greatest return on the least amount of effort, trying to minimise the amount of resource that you're consuming. It's about placing the kind of components in your living system in sensible places so that the output from one component is the input to the next. And so the effort and resource just dissipates spontaneously from your centre of activity to the periphery. It's pertinent here in Palestine. More pertinent here than anywhere else I could think to work, and I have worked in other places. I mean, why aren't I doing this in England, where I'm from? Well, here I think it's crucial. It's in fact perhaps the only way that there's going to be any wastewater management, treatment, solid waste management. The government has no sovereignty. The municipality, they're bound by the restrictions of the occupation. They can only act within Zone A, even then. So it falls to the people. If everybody here is distressed by the lack of water and the constant loss of land and the ever decreasing ability to provide food nationally, for the domestic market due to lack of water mainly and land confiscation. So if people are to address these issues which are worrying them, then they have to act themselves, because no higher agency is capable of for instance building a sewage treatment plant, because it's not permitted. So it's never happened. Like, I think there's one in all of the West Bank. Neither the settlements nor the Arab towns and villages have any wastewater treatment. So people can change to compost toilets, as they were using just 50 years ago. Like, our compost toilet here is the original. We didn't build it, we didn't have to do anything to it, we just started reusing it. It was well designed to begin with. So yeah, we're here in the Bustan Karaka project, where we have an experimental centre, basically, to try to find techniques to address these problems. Just very elegant, low-tech solutions, very cheap, which individuals or small groups of people can build quickly, just using the soil, using the earth, and using the native species. And in this way, we hope to help people to take back control over such vital things as water and food provision for their families. And at the same time, we can protect the Palestinian environment and even begin to remediate the damage that's been done, because it's in a pretty pretty poor state right now. It's been suffering something of an onslaught of pollution and erosion and just basic degradation and desertification there. The climate's changed and many of the soils have degraded. If you walk out into the Judean desert to the east here, you can see Ottoman farms on very barren ridgetops, which I infer to mean that once the kind of the fertile agricultural land, the humid soil, reached further out to the east than it does today. I think what's happening is the Judean desert's creeping up the mountain slope into Bethlehem, and that's happening region-wide. So although land like this is now considered marginal and it's considered something of an expensive hobby to try to farm under such challenging conditions, people need to learn how to farm this sort of semi-arid farmland successfully, because globally it's increasing in area with global climate change and desertification. It's a global issue, like many of the issues here in Palestine. they're not unique to Palestine.
In the occupied West Bank, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Alice, an environmental scientist from the UK, helped start the Bustan Karaka farm in Beit Sahour. She explains why it's a vital community and cultural resource.
On a very basic level, it's a case of people taking care of their needs. Now, I've read the food security report from 2008, And this isn't a movement for yuppies, you know. This is like, to us, it's a very grassroots concern. These are real problems that people are facing. Like, there's so many Palestinians who have water problems. And increasingly, there's so many Palestinians who can't afford vegetables for their families. Like, this is what the report from, like, the Food and Agriculture Organization, the World Food Programme and UNRWA is saying. People are increasingly on life support, right? They're just having basics delivered to them. By the refugee agencies and by Western aid agencies, and actually they can't even afford to supplement that. So this is like an immediate question, like how do we get more food? Well, we suggest that people could grow it. Even like we're trying to develop ways of doing this in an urban context. I mean, it's the next step actually, like everything moves a bit slowly, but we really want to look at rooftop gardening and like water reuse, like for refugee camps, these kind of ideas. And the other huge concern, of course, is rainwater harvesting and creating more water storage, because everyone needs that. Like in the summer here, there's barely anyone who doesn't at some point experience a water outage. And like, obviously the more storage you have, the more stability you have. You can combine that. So if you build rainwater harvesting, you're immediately building storage. And then that storage, once the rainwater is used, can be used through the summer just to stabilize your water situation. So yeah, I mean, this is very basic level. This is like everyday concerns. And I guess, I mean, this is the fundamental point of the project, but at the political level, what does that mean? Well, it means that people are more able to exercise their basic freedoms without like being faced with the repercussions that Gaza has faced, perhaps, where if you misbehave, your water supply is cut off. this is quite a good tool for controlling people, no? And it like generates fear, because being without water in the Middle East in the summer is no joke.
Meanwhile, in the Israeli settlement colonies and everywhere inside the Green Line, they have swimming pools and hot water every day and all this.
Yeah, there's a very clear case of inequality in access to resources. And this is something that is not being addressed. Like, environmental justice as a whole is not addressed. It's not on the negotiating table. To me, it's absolutely fundamental to the occupation. This is how they assert their control over the land and over the people. It's through grabbing resources. If you look at like Zionist documents dating back to before the formation of the Israeli state, like this was thought about and planned for, how to, you know, Zionists understood that access to water was absolutely key to establishing their state also. And they had planned to seize most of the water resources, and they've done so very successfully. Yeah. I don't think, from what I see in Israel, that they're about to hand any of it back. It may be unjust, it is unjust, but it's true that they're not about to give it back. You know, like Israel talks, I mean, Israel leads the world to an extent in technology for water conservation and water reuse. But if you look at any of their planning documents, what they are planning for is not to redress the balance with Palestinians, it's to cope with their expanding population. There is no plan to give water back. So how do Palestinians cope, and how do Palestinians plan for population growth or for having a farming sector? Well, in my opinion, all of these things are possible. It's just that Palestinians are forced into a situation where they have to be smarter. Palestine could lead the world actually also in like arid zones agriculture, because you know, like, I can't even remember what proportion of the farming it is, but it's over 80% of the farming is rain-fed. It's already, like, traditionally quite a sustainable agriculture setup. I mean, the trouble is that now also not only, like, adapting to a situation, like, where Israel controls all the resources, Palestine has to also adapt to climate change, which is great, as if there weren't enough problems already. But yeah, it's predicted that rainfall over this area, over the Middle East, will decrease by as much as 20% by 2050. And if you look at the downwards trends of the last 20 years, this seems to be true. Should certainly be prepared for it. But the question is, you know, with like permaculture techniques, there are crops you can grow, there are things you can do. And you know, actually, I mean, as Tom maybe like mentioned, this farm is one of the, in the more arid sort of zones of Palestine. And we kind of chose it deliberately like that. I mean, friends of ours who are farmers in like Al-Walaja and Bet Jala, they have like much greater rainfall. And they're like, why don't you farm up here? It's much better. And
we're like, it's a challenge.
Yeah, sure, it's much better. But this is the thing, like the whole of Palestine might be like this in 20 years. And so, yeah, we're kind of looking for like what you do when it's like this, like what crops you could grow and like, are there different ways of doing things? These kind of ideas.
Reporting on Earth Day from the Bustan Karaka farm in Beit Sahour, occupied West Bank in Palestine, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. For more information on the farm, please visit www.bustankaraka.org. BustanKaraka.org. In Bethlehem, occupied West Bank, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Yesterday, across occupied Palestine, Palestinians inside the Green Line and in the occupied West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip commemorated Land Day, an annual event created to call attention to historical and current day apartheid and confiscation of Palestinian land by the Israeli state. This year's 33rd anniversary day of protests was also combined with the first annual Global Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Day as a means of attaching historical struggle for land and justice with proactive strategies to counter today's apartheid policies. In Deir Hanna in the north, thousands of Palestinians marched and held a rally near an olive grove in this village nestled between rolling green hills and the blue sea of Galilee. Flags of different political factions whipped in the wind, and the intergenerational crowd wore buttons and stickers encouraging boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel. Hazem Jamjoum of Badil Resource Center for Palestinian Residency and Refugee Rights.
After 1948, the Israeli state continued to confiscate land en masse. In 1976, they announced a plan to confiscate several thousand dunams of land in this area, around Sakhnin and Arrabe and Deir Hanna, where we are today. And what happened was the community and mainly the left organized the general strike that basically brought out the entire population of this area on strike and who started to demonstrate. And so on March 30th, 1976, all the demonstrations went out into the streets and the Israeli police and army opened fire onto the demonstrators, killing six and injuring several hundred people and arresting several thousand. And so that began, Palestinians commemorate this as Land Day or Yom al-Ard. And so every year since 1976, Land Day is one of the most important days on the Palestinian calendar around the world. And these days, what's been happening is Land Day is used as a day to protest further land confiscation. And since Palestinians everywhere are facing land confiscation, there are demonstrations across historic Palestine, specifically in the West Bank and inside the Green Line, demonstrating to defend Palestinian land.
And today is also Global Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Day. What's the significance of that, especially here in Deir Hanna?
Well, the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions movement in the rest of the world is one of the key, or the key way of acting out in solidarity with the Palestinian people. Inside Palestine, Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions is part of a larger philosophy of non-cooperation. And so for Palestinian citizens of Israel, Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions, or BDS, is essentially the building of local economy. It's beginning to be able to rely on ourselves here, and also developing further links between Palestinian citizens of Israel, Palestinians under occupation in the West Bank and Gaza, and Palestinian refugees.
Makboul al-Nassar is an activist and accomplished photographer from Arabe.
My name is Makboul al-Nassar. I'm from Arabe, and Arabe is one of the villages that that triangle, the villages of the Land Day in 1976.
And can you tell me a little bit about why you're here today, why it's important for people from your community to be here?
I am in the Land Day each year since I was five, and I was born 2 years before the Land Day. So this is some kind of tradition, political tradition. It's a tradition of our struggle also. It's a symbol of our struggle that we, each year we commit, we stay holding our principles, our rights. We, even though that our lands that was confiscated in 76 was returned by struggle, but although the Israeli policy is still continuing, meeting the same policy of less Palestinians and more land with the Zionist authorities. So our struggle will never end till the occupation will end, until our rights will be returned and our lands will be returned and the right of return for the refugees will be also accomplished. So this is a tradition and a symbol of our struggle that will never stop, and you will see me, the generation that have been born in the years of the Land Day, and the children and the old men, everybody will hold this symbol as the first resistance of the Israeli occupation inside the Green Line.
And there are a lot of children here too. Can you talk a little bit about how the children are growing up these days with the aggravated, you know, accelerated settler movement and the Zionists and their struggle?
The same control strategy that Israel is doing since 60 years with the Palestinians inside Israel is making the Palestinians ignorant about our history and about our lands, about our political issues and about our ID. But in the last maybe 15 years, we have more and more awareness. We have more and more ways and new ways to handle this package and this kind of knowledge to the next generation. And I'm so happy to see the children actually really understanding why they are here and why we are struggling and who are they also to know that they are Palestinians and the others are the one who's occupying us.
And finally, this is also a Global Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions Day, Global BDS Day, yeah? And you're wearing a sticker. Can you tell me what your sticker says and how important Global BDS is?
It's a sticker for boycotting Israel, because I think that the same way that happened with apartheid in South Africa, we will struggle inside. In the West Bank, there's daily life struggle all the time. And I think that there's a lot of people in the world who actually identify with our issue and with our struggle. But it needs strategies. Boycotting Israel could be a good strategy that could be a price that Israel will be hurted by in order to change its policies. And without this voice, I think we need the world with us to boycott Israel in order to succeed. It's gathering hands together from all over the world, from all those who want or who dream of freedom and justice in the world.
Thank you so much.
Welcome.
Raj El-Khatib is the mayor of Deir Hanna, and we asked him about the historical and current significance of Land Day in this community.
Together with Sakhnin and Arrabe, Deir Hanna has the honor of being one of the three villages from which the original Land Day demonstrations were launched as part of the 1976 general strike. Since then, there has been a rotation of the central Land Day demonstration, which is held in one of the three villages each year. The spark for the 1976 Land Day demonstration was ignited in Deir Hanna, in this field where we are standing, and where this year's commemoration is taking place.
How do you feel today's demonstration went, and what effect do you think it will have on the Palestinian national movement?
Actions like the one today entrench and enhance the strength and consciousness of our youth. These youth who did not experience the first Land Day in 1976, it is essential that the older generation passes on its experience and the lessons of the struggle to the younger generations, so they can use it to carry on the struggle.
Land Day / Global Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions, BDS Day, was commemorated across Palestine, with protests not only inside the Green Line, where the original Israeli attacks took place, but also inside occupied East Jerusalem, as well as numerous cities, towns, and villages in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip. And across the international spectrum, over 80 actions in 20 cities worldwide took part in the Global BDS Day, where activists organized protests, sit-ins, and consumer boycotts targeting Israeli corporations, academic and cultural institutions, and sports teams.
In the West Bank city of Ramallah, Jamal Jumaah, director of the Stop the Wall campaign.
You know, I'm happy that the message of the world started to get to them. You know, they became started to understand it. Because like the unlimited support that they have been given by Europe, by the regimes around the world, like, and by the United States government, just like make them much more arrogant and much more racist and looking down to the human beings' lives even, and like even mentalities, undermining them, even they terrorize the people around the world for decades. Anyone want to talk against Zionism as a racist ideology, it became like threatened and became chased and became punished, and it's still going on. They didn't finish. But they started to feel that they are not above the human beings. They are not from like different planet. They are part of this planet, and their hands is not free to kill whenever they want, to keep abusing the people as they want, to take whatever they want, and to at the same time to go travel to the world as if they are civilized like people who's like very welcome. Even still, they are there to call themselves the victims. In spite of all the crimes that they are doing against the people here, this is not going to be without any price. They are going to be to pay heavy price for this. And it's better for them just to learn this lessons from now. This is a sentence. And they have to learn the lesson from this sentence. Because if they keep dealing with the world in an arrogant way like this, they are going to pay a real heavy price out of this.
That was Jamal Jumaah, director of the Stop the Wall campaign in the West Bank city of Ramallah. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, with special thanks to Becca Wolf and Hazem Jamjoum. Reporting from the West Bank, occupied Palestine, this is Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Occupied Palestine, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. On Sunday evening, Israeli Orthodox settlers, backed by soldiers and police, attacked Palestinian residents of the Saadiyya neighborhood of occupied East Jerusalem, 4 days after the settler group invaded the home of the Jaber family and extrajudicially evicted them. The settlers claim ownership of the Jaber home and several other homes in Saadiyya, even after an Israeli court had decided to examine an appeal filed by Palestinian families contesting the legitimacy of the settlers' claims. 3 Palestinians were injured and several were beaten and arrested by Israeli police when residents of the neighborhood attempted to protect the Jaber home and restrain the settlers and Israeli forces. At the same time, near Saadiyya in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, Palestinian families there are also facing expanding settler attacks, evictions, and court battles that threaten their homes. After Palestinians were expelled and dispossessed from their villages and towns in 1948, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, cooperated with the Jordanian government in 1956 to build housing units for refugees in Sheikh Jarrah, within an agreement that would trade UNRWA refugee benefits for permanent housing for these relocated Palestinian families. In 1972, however, Israeli settler groups began what would be a lengthy process of filing legal suits over land titles, claiming ownership of the property, and pursuing subsequent eviction of the Palestinian families in Sheikh Jarrah. Forged documents of land ownership were submitted by the settler groups, resulting in a court order that forced the Palestinian families to pay rent. Although in 2006, when the documents were proved fraudulent, the Israeli court ruled the settlers' claim void, but did not reinstate the Palestinian families' rightful ownership to their land. However, it was too late. In 2008, the settler group sold the land in Sheikh Jarrah to an Israeli investment company which currently plans to demolish the neighborhood and build 200 housing units for exclusive Jewish use. After these plans were made, settlers began invading and occupying Palestinian homes in Sheikh Jarrah. Maher Hanoun sits in the veranda of his modest but classic Jerusalem house. Green clematis vines crawl along the outside stone wall. Children play a game of soccer in the alleyway across the street. Hanoun's quiet home finds itself in the direct crosshairs of what he calls the latest round of Israeli colonization in this area.
My name is Maher Hanoun. I'm living at Jerusalem at the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. And I give you a little speech about our neighborhood. It's about 28 houses. We are 500 people living here. And we are took those houses from Jordanian government and UNRWA, which is mean that we are here legally because there is an agreement between us and between Jordanian government. So the Israelian came at 72, they claimed that they own this land. And we are at the court since 37 years. And I will tell you about our situation now. Now they claim that they own this land and we have to pay money as a rent. So our lawyer bring a lot of documents, more than 13 documents, which prove that a Palestinian guy is on this land. But the problem here that the court, she didn't want to hear and she didn't want to see all those documents. I hope there is a justice here, but I don't think, because as I told you, 37 years we are suffering at the court and they don't want to see the documents. Always they said, you are late to bring the documents. And the settlers don't late, they bring a document which they claim they own this land before 130 years. They don't late, but we are late.
Can you talk about how the settlers themselves have been able to take over homes and what that's like? What that's like for Palestinian families when these settler groups come in and take over homes?
You see, when you see the settlers take your houses and damage your houses and build another houses for settlers, sure, it's hurt you. They built settler houses on our dreams, on our hopes, to let us homeless, to let us move from East Jerusalem, go to West Bank or to Jordan. They, as I told you, they need the land empty without people. Because of that, we will be here and will be fight for our rights as a human being. We are here refugees and we are a human being. We are not coming from the moon. We are here since hundreds of years. I will ask the judge if he can tell me from where his father or his grandfather. I can prove from my where my father and the grandfather, they was at Palestine. But if he can prove from where, I will agree with him later.
My question also is, can you talk about what happens specifically? Like, do the settlers come and knock on your door in the middle of the night? And then how do they get to take over? Like, how do they take over somebody's house in this neighborhood?
Yes, the settlers didn't come by themselves. The policeman came. More than 500 policemen will came, because when they gave me the order, he asked me to move quietly because he want to bring 500 policemen to move me out. And you know, we don't have weapons here to protect ourselves. Just we have our body and we have our voice to let all the people know our problem. That's the way we can protect our house and our family and our kids. That's the way we can do it. They came with weapons, with horses, with hammers, and you know, a lot of policemen, they came for to move a civilian people. They don't have nothing.
Sheikh Nasser Al-Gawi is also facing eviction and home demolition in the same neighborhood. 7 years ago, he was forced out of his home by Israeli police and lived in a tent beside his house.
In 2002, there is a decision of the court, the middle court, to evacuate me and Maher Hanoun. And actually, there is evacuate me and Maher Hanoun, and we live in tent beside the house till 4 months. And after 4 months, I haven't any place to go, and no house, no land. And we return back to the houses till 2006. And in 2006, there is laws in the High Court, and the High Court said there is no enough documents to the other side, and the Arab side also. So there is don't feel good when there are laws. In 2006, they went and they sell this land to another association to destroy these houses and to build 250 units for the settlers' people. And now we have a new document from Turkey and from the Archive of the State of Israel. It said that this land, the ownership is Darwish Sulaiman Darwish Hijazi. And we sent it to the court, and the court said, okay, it's a very old paper, we don't take it, and the decision is negative. And we went to the evacuate decision, or to active it, and we have to go to the High Court. Maybe the High Court give a free decision. And we hope only for goods and to bring my house and to peace.
And you said that you were first forced into a tent beside your house for 4 months?
Yes.
Can you talk about what that process was like? Like, take us from the day that they said that you needed to leave and how it was for those 4 months living beside your house, which you could not enter.
It's been very easy. You know, it's only to defend my house, because I'm sure it's my house, it's not the other house. Because there is the Ministry of Houses, his name is Beni Alon. He is a crazy settler. And he came and asked me, okay, Mr. Nasser, how many people you are inside this tent? I said it was 17. And he said to me, okay, take $70 million and leave the zone of the municipality of Jerusalem. I don't say go to Austria or to Germany or France or Jordan or Saudi Arabia. Okay, just leave the zone of the municipality of Jerusalem. I'm said, oh, crazy. If it's at your house, you can't imagine it. You have to pay more money to bring your house, if it's at your house. And he said, oh, you are crazy. And he's gone.
So he offered you $17 million.
Yes. And you know, $17 million you cannot pay for my members. So I'm born in this house, you know, not in hospital, I'm born in this house. So $17 million is not money. If you imagine it, your members, your blood here is mixed in this land, everything.
One family in particular has received some attention from reporters and international human rights groups. After the Israeli court ruled in favor of settlers to evict them, the Al-Kurd family were thrown out of their home in November of 2008 and have since lived in a canvas tent below their house in a former trash dump as settlers move freely in and around the Al-Kurd property. The court based the eviction on the Al-Kurd family's refusal to pay rent to the settlers. Fawzia Abdelkader Jabal Al-Kurd, better known as Kamel, speaks to flashpoints inside her tent. I asked her to explain her situation.
طبعا اهلي احنا مواطنين من الطلبيه دار حماي من حي العجم بيافا وانا من سكان حي الشيخ جراح من مواليد البلد القديمه.
She's a refugee. Her father came from Talbiyeh and their father-in-law came from Jaffa and she used to live in Sheikh Jarrah.
And tell us a little bit about how you came to be living in this tent. What happened?
طبعا في ليلة 9/11 اجت قوة كتير يعني قوة فظيعة كتير واخرجتني من البيت بالعراء وساعة 3:30 بالليل حوالي 50 واحد دخل
On the 9th of November she was sitting in their home with her husband and like 50 soldiers came in with 3 women soldiers. They entered the house with settlers. They occupied the house. They throw both of them outside of the house. Her husband immediately had a heart attack because they throw him in another separated room than her. And they didn't let the ambulance to come in, so they had to take their father's, her sons to the hospital. He had his first attack. Then she, after they release her from the, you know, investigation, they brought her back here. So she decided to build this tent, and they brought her husband back to here. The next day he got another heart attack, and then they took him to a hospital next by, and then he passed away after a week.
Allah rahmahu. So, describe your house. Describe the history of your house. Describe the things that went on, you know, in your life, in your husband's life there at the house.
طبعاً شو أشرح حياتي كلها في ذكرياتي كلها في خلفت أولادي في جوزت أولادي في حصلت صرت جدة وأنا في في الآخر ألقيت بالشارع.
She cannot explain to you. This is a question that it's like for her it's very funny because this is a home. This is a place that you born, you gave birth to children. You saw your first niece in it, your first nephew. It's like all the history inside it. Her husband in the beginning they were living there. She have all this small, you know, the nicest memory and the oldest memory and the suffering memory. So she, as much as she can be and you know, very specific, it's something that she cannot answer. It's like your own home. So,
and what's the status of the house now, and how close are you right now in your tent to the house?
الوضع البيت هلا في مستوطنين شباب بحطوا فيه بتناوبوا بقعدوا في البيت وقريب من الخيمه للبيت حوالي بس فيش 200 متر طول يعني او 150 متر طول لو بدك تمشي بالاجر بس 150 متر طول بس.
It's 150 meters from here. You just walk from it because it's very close. And nowadays settlers living in it, and settlers are actually controlling on it, and they have shifts every 5, you know, days or 2 days they will shift for other groups, and she cannot even reach it. She can reach it by walk, but she cannot enter it actually.
And all of your belongings, all of your books, everything is still inside.
ولا إشي أخذت طلعوني في البيجامة هو طلعوا في البيجامة.
She didn't take anything because the minute they enter the house they throw them outside.
Can you talk a little bit about the legal fight and what's happening with that?
احنا قضائيا اول شيء قانونيا سليم القانون 100% لانه احنا لما اخذنا البيوت هون بالشيخ جراح احنا مهجرين من القدس الغربيه واخذنا هذه البيوت على سبب.
She said that the legal things is very difficult because nowadays we are trying to prove that, and we have the proof that we went to the Ottoman archives. We have too many documents that prove that this land actually belonged to a guy called Salman Darwish Hijazi. That the Israelis actually by illegal documents, by fake documents, they're trying to prove that this is their own land, which is actually is fake because since the beginning, the owner of the land was Palestinians. Now the Jews actually trying, or the settlers actually trying to prove that it is not. And in a way, when the court is actually deciding and, you know, relying on courts that it was before, not looking more deeply to the cases, it's very difficult to have a decent decision. So in this case, in our case, what she's saying is that there is no correct decision. There is no, a decision that it's for Palestinians. They all will say, no, it's a settlement, it's their settlements, it's the settlements. And what she's trying to prove that it's also, in a long time ago, this land was Jordanian. So how come now Israeli claims that they have it?
And this tent now has become a very important and popular symbol of resistance within the community, but also it's traveled. I mean, you know, we hear about this, you know, 10,000 miles away. What can you say about the spirit of this community and the support that this community has given you?
أول شيء هي أنا ما إلي أي علاقة بأي خيمة، أنا إلي علاقة بخيمتي. أنا هاي الخيمة انفرضت علي، مش أنا الفرضت علي، لأنه أنا انطردت من البيت أول وثاني.
It's very difficult to explain it because it's something that it's belonging to everybody. Everybody in the neighborhood actually will have faced the same thing, and she's refusing to say I will stay here all my life in this tent. There is one case that she will leave this tent. It's only when she go back to her home, which it seems like this neighborhood actually all of them are suffering from eviction order, and they will have sooner or later the same thing. So in a way it's like home, it's gonna be this area full with tents, so it doesn't matter if you have in Silwan, because it's Silwan soon will have the same thing, Atur will have the same thing. So it's like something that it's actually now it's like a fashion in the Israelis, rules that these tents are actually controlling the whole thing by evacuation orders, by demolishing orders, by all kind of orders.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio as we investigate the situation for Palestinians facing settler colonialism inside occupied East Jerusalem. On Sunday, the Israeli High Court rejected the Sheikh Jarrah community's appeal against evictions and home demolitions. Before I return to the neighborhood, I interviewed Jimmy Johnson, international coordinator with the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions in Jerusalem.
In Sheikh Jarrah, for a large part of it, is built as a refugee community, built by UNRWA, the United Nations Relief Works Agency, after the 1948 war. And the UNRWA, working with the Jordanian government, which occupied the West Bank and East Jerusalem at the time, got building permits and residency rights for certain degrees of numbers of refugees, and they were granted titles to the land so that they would no longer be counted as refugees. It was a resettlement program of sorts. And what has happened since 1967, though, after Israel's occupation of East Jerusalem and West Bank began, is that some of the titles have been challenged in Israeli courts. One of the ways that many settlements have been founded here inside East Jerusalem and also in the West Bank is finding land that was owned by Jews prior to 1948 and then using the bureaucracy to try and reclaim the land. In some cases, this is done with a legitimate tie to previous ownership, such as in the settlement of Kfar Etzion, south of Bethlehem. There was a kibbutz prior to 1948 called Kfar Etzion, and so that's one of the ways that that settlers gain property. And in theory, it's not even really a bad law. Although if it was applied universally, you'd find it to be the least popular law in the history of Israel to have all pre-1948 property returned to its original owners, because it's the whole country. So instead, this law is indicative and demonstrative of this hierarchy of privilege, the official hierarchy of privilege we have here between Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs. And in the case of Sheikh Jarrah, this is compounded by the fact that this law is being invoked, this restitution of property is being invoked with fraudulent documents even. Which is another way that settlers sometimes gain property, is by straight fraud. Inside the Israeli legal system, all of this can be challenged. You know, Israel has all of these laws and all of this, and we can go to court to challenge these things. On rare occasions, we might even win. Generally speaking, we don't. In the case of fraudulent documents, what the court oftentimes finds is that, these documents are fake, but it wasn't through any blame of the settlers, and they can't be punished for someone else's crime, for someone else's fraud, and that's one of the ways that settlers get property, and that's what's going on in Sheikh Jarrah right now. There are four houses in the Shimon HaTzadik settlement, which is nearby the Yanun and other families that are facing confiscation. There are four houses there that were owned by Jews prior to 1948. And even people inside the community say that, you know what, yeah, that's kind of their houses. And they still oppose it because it's still a settlement. And of course, it's still indicative of this hierarchy of privilege. But the bigger claim is that with these other 28 units, one of which has already been confiscated, the Al-Kurd family, there was no previous ownership of this land. There was an old rental agreement under Ottoman times, nothing to do with titles of the land or anything like this. And instead, there have been forged documents saying that there was owned by Jews. And this is the mechanism that's being used. And unfortunately, they've lost in court as well. And so the only recourse that remains is international pressure.
Jimmy, the Israeli court has been really kind of flip-flopping on this issue over the past few years. In 2006, the court ruled in favor of the Palestinian mm-hmm. families and said that the settlers could not evict these families. Mm-hmm. And then in 2008, they reversed their decision and ruled in favor of the settlers. And again, just this past weekend, mm-hmm. they ruled against the Palestinians again, who filed an appeal against that decision. How can you assess the role of the Israeli court right now?
Schizophrenia is probably the best way to go about it. A lot of times, In theory, we don't have a constitution. There's the basic law, but in theory, the majority of the legal mechanisms here are precedent-based law, and so each high court ruling should form the policy for the next one. But instead, we oftentimes have grossly contradictory rulings on the exact same issue. You can bring the same complaint about the wall in two different areas and come up with two different rulings on it. And so, in this sense, there's not an easily observable external logic. And the best explanation is that the court rulings tend to change a bit with both the security atmosphere and political leanings. Not just amongst the people in the court themselves, but inside of Israel and inside of the international community, and acting a bit of a litmus test of sorts.
Can you talk about what this means in terms of like the entire context of occupied East Jerusalem right now, and the settler movement, and of course the new Knesset, and Avigdor Lieberman, who is a settler himself? Take us through what's happening right now.
It's a couple of things. Peripheral movements inside of Israel, including the settler movement, which has never been a mainstream movement, have always had a disproportionate amount of power due to the way that the Israeli government is set up. For example, in these last elections, the party that won the most seats, the Kadima, won 28 out of 120 seats, and you need 61 to form a governing coalition. And so what this means is that if you try to put a coalition together, you need the support of these peripheral parties. And it gives them, for example, the National Union and Habayit HaYehudi and all of these parties, they have far more power than the four or five seats that they won in Knesset. Their power seems more like a 20-seat party. And for this reason, it makes, in the context, of course, of a Netanyahu-Lieberman government, it makes it all the more dangerous, I think. Now, with regards to the Judaization of East Jerusalem, I'm pretty sure that neither the Jerusalem municipality nor the Israeli government has any illusions about being able to evict the Palestinians from East Jerusalem. They can take over specific areas, and the zoning and planning and transfers of property from Palestinians to settlers certainly are mechanisms of demographic control. But at the end of the day, this isn't 1948, and Israel can't get away with it. Got away with then. And in this context, I think, without trying to minimize the personal trauma inflicted on these individual families in Sheikh Jarrah, the bigger question in East Jerusalem is of the large settlements. The total number of units that can be built could house a little less than 1,000 people in Sheikh Jarrah if the settlers have their wildest fantasies come true. Whereas just outside of East Jerusalem, in the Maale Adumim's new settlement area, could have as many as 10,000 new settlers, which totally dominate the urban infrastructure of East Jerusalem and prevent it from having any type of viable economic activity in the future. And you find that's the same in a lot of ways with the various settler movements, and that the popular image of a settler, both in the Israeli mind but also in the international public, is a man with a kippah, a collar, and a machine gun, you know, and who's probably a religious nationalist or someone who sees themselves as on the forefront of a messianic movement. They're generally thought of in that sense. And it's probably not possible to make a direct line between who we would call an ideological settler like that and an economic settler, people who live in settlements for economic incentives. But out of the around 500,000 total settlers, it's probably fair to say that around 80,000 are what we call this popular image of a settler. And they tend to live in small settlements that don't dominate the infrastructure. The exception to that is, of course, Kiryat Arba and the settlements in the old city of Hebron, because it intrudes directly into a Palestinian urban area. The other ideological settlements are at best peripheral.
And there's ones like Yitzhar and Itamar, which were founded in 1971 and 1973, that still have yet to reach 800 total people, because no one wants to live there, because the people who live there are ideological extremists in the bad sense of the word, and you know, crazy and whatever else you want to say. And generally speaking, Israelis who tend to see ourselves as like secular liberal type folks, they're not quite so... You know, they can't really identify with that. That national religious stuff, that's a little out there. But they have no problem with their cousin who lives in Maale Adumim, which is a gigantic settlement that dominates East Jerusalem, or Pisgat Ze'ev, which has 55,000 people. You know, these are very mainstream, and these are what dominate the geography of the West Bank and reorient the entire country to be to have these urban settlements be part of the Israeli urban sphere, be part of the Tel Aviv metropolitan area or the Jerusalem metropolitan area. And so with regards to the ideological settlers, like those who are trying to go into Sheikh Jarrah right now, they're causing a massive amount of damage on a local level. And but if you talk to the East Jerusalem settler movement people, because, you know, one of the things that comes with extremism is that they're very open about everything, you know, because they've got this confidence and, you know, because God said so and all of this stuff. And so they'll say very clearly, you know, what their goals are. And you can look at it on a map. You can see that they're trying to surround the old city of Jerusalem with a sufficiently dense Jewish population to prejudice the status of the land in any future negotiations. Now, what the very mainstream non-messianic government of Israel and municipality is doing, they're doing it with all of East Jerusalem. They're taking a huge chunk of land. And so you've got these various rings of damage to the Palestinian urban area. The settlers are trying to do it around the old city. Partially for religious reasons, partially for, for religious reasons, basically. But the mainstream government of Israel is far more interested in dominating the geography and controlling the whole of the West Bank and controlling the urban core around East Jerusalem, the Jordan Valley, and then expanding the greater Tel Aviv metropolitan area across the 1967 border. This is what the Israeli government is trying to do.
That was Jimmy Johnson of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. Yesterday, after word got out that the Israeli High Court rejected the neighborhood community's appeal late on Sunday, I went back to the home of Maher Hanoun in Sheikh Jarrah.
So we are her civilian people. We have an international people with us and Israeli people, which is believe that we are right. We are fighting by our bodies and our voice. The most important things to let all the people around the world know our problem and know our situation here. And I'm so glad there is international people helping us because they believe in human rights. So later, we will be homeless. We don't have any land or any apartment to be with it. And as you know, we are refugees here, and we do not have nothing, just this house. I born here, and also my kids born here, and I do not have nothing, just this house. Because of that, I will fight for the last moment at this home, during the court, during the international court, by diplomatic pressure. What I can do, I will do it.
Maher Hanoun facing eviction and house demolition in Sheikh Jarrah. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, reporting from occupied East Jerusalem, Palestine.